Chefs at Johnson & Wales and in thousands of restaurants around the globe will tell you that the hottest name in hand-forged Japanese-style knives at an affordable price is Forged to Table. The company, founded in 2017 by Johnson & Wales alum Noah Rosen, when he was still a student, is dedicated to the pursuit of the perfect knife for culinary students, working chefs, and home cooks alike. His guiding motto is uncompromising quality at a fair price. Though Noah has long not been a student, he is still dedicated to the same pursuit in everything he does. His flagship blade, the 8-inch Gyoto Chef's Knife, has developed a cult following among kitchen professionals across the country and internationally, by the way. Jamie, what is your most appropriate Forged Table reference for what we're going to be talking about today?
Well, because we're talking cheese, and whether you want to cut a wheel of Opus 42, Morgan, Cascadella Blue, or something soft like Medallion from Lincoln's Gorgeous Cheese, I love the utility knife. And it's a 6-inch knife, and I love it not just for cutting cheese, but also for everyday use. It's honestly my go-to knife at home for everything I do, no matter what I'm doing.
Yes, the 12-year-old boy in me cannot resist the cut the cheese joke. But if you are going to cut the cheese, do me a favor and use a Forged Table utility knife. It is legit. You can order that knife.
I just want to say, before you talk about where to order it, I say this all the time, but I I love the Forged Table knives. I know that they're our sponsor, but I really do love them because they're beautiful, they're lightweight, they're easy to sharpen. And those are three things I look for when I'm looking for a knife, and Forged Table delivers.
A little added love right there to the Forged Table brand. Okay, so you can order any of those knives for any of those reasons that Jamie just talked about at ForgedTable.com. And at checkout, put in our promo code CulinaryNow, all one word, to get 15% off these beautiful handmade knives. I really appreciate the opportunity that Forged Table gives to our listeners to get this incredible deal. Yes. Be sure to follow Forged Table at Forged Table on Instagram and all other social platforms to see what they're doing in their test kitchen, to get the loop on new exciting knives and kitchen gear, plus be eligible for some giveaways, which they do on the regular. Forged Table is proud to support the development of new and aspiring cooks and chefs everywhere, and to join in the effort to create a better industry for us all.
And we love them for that.
Welcome, everyone, to the Culinary Now podcast. I'm Matt Britt.
And I'm Jamie Schick. And today we are joined by Allison Lakin from Lakin's Gorgeous Cheese. And we are so excited to talk all things cheese with you today. So thank you so much for being here with us, Allison. Well, I want to start with kind of your journey, because you're actually an anthropology major and now you've turned cheesemaker. Can you walk us through that process and how you ended up here?
That would be the left turn at Albuquerque. I got a degree in anthropology from Cornell University. So if any of you Cornell folks, if you're thinking Lakin's Gorgeous Cheese, if that's ringing a bell, it is the nod to Ithaca. I had a museum career. I actually started while I was still in college, and evolved into my being the director of education for a couple of different museums, and creating programs that were from pre-K up to senior citizens. And through that, I was getting to tell the story of basically everything. And so when people say, how does anthropology relate to cheese making? It's like, well, it's everything, you know, it's talking about food preservation. It's talking about what's happening with the livestock and how is the land being used. And I still feel like that part of my brain is very much engaged. I reached a point where I needed to not be in the nonprofit world anymore. And I made one of those great lists of skills, things that I liked to do, things that I thought that maybe I might enjoy doing that I wasn't doing as much of. And it just happened that someone brought to my attention an ad for a farm in New York State that made cheese, but was also a working educational farm. I was not hired to be the cheesemaker, but I fairly quickly took over making the cheese. And I frequently use the term that it fit like a glove, because it's science, it's art, it's, you know, there's a whole educational component to it, because I think it's important to not only teach other people about the skills, but also to teach consumers about what it is that they're eating. And I had the opportunity there because it was a working farm. I was right there with the cows. And so I got this great groundwork laid. I did end up going back into the museum world for a few years. And then finally in 2011, I was living in Maine, and I had this epiphany of, I don't want to keep being miserable in my work life. And there was a cheese company locally, which was the State of Maine Cheese Company. And I knew that they had a vat that they weren't always using. And I walked in there one day and I said, what do you think? Could we work out a way that I could lease space from you and make cheese? And she said, let me have a little bit of time to think about it. And a day later, she's like, yeah, we're going to make this work. And so I had the incredible gift of being able to start a cheese company without all the overhead. You know, all the equipment was there. I didn't have to worry about utilities. I just had to come up with, a milk source. And it was, 11 years later, I now own my own farm, and I'm producing. So I start my day off milking cows and then getting to use the absolute freshest milk in the cheese. And it's been an amazing journey to get to this point.
That is amazing. And first off, shout out Maine. Like, I'm a Mainer at heart. I grew up in parts of Southern Maine in York, which I know is not really Maine, but like, I still claim it as like, you know, I'm a Mainer at heart. And so shout out to Maine. Love it. I want to talk a little bit about Maine specifically, because, and I love cheese. I think that, you know, cheese is milk's leap towards immortality. It's the most amazing thing in the world. But in my limited scope, because I'm humble, when I think of great cheese in the world, you know, I think of California, France, New York. I mean, you could throw Wisconsin, but we know that that's a different type. Maine, it probably wouldn't be on my short list. And that's not because it's not a real thing, but it's probably just because there's not enough promotion coming out of the great work that's going on there. Can you speak to how the climate in Maine maybe impacts the milk and how that really creates this amazing product?
So Maine is a very interesting state, because so many of the people that have moved to the state or have had life transformations within the state end up with goats. And I blame goats on Maine cheese. If you start with a couple of goats, they will make more, and then they have milk, and then you have to figure out something to do. So a lot of people end up either making goat's milk soap or start making cheese. And I think that the sort of the arc of Maine cheese started with the backyard goats. Over the years that has evolved, that there are, Maine is very friendly to agricultural businesses. And when I started my company in 2011, there were about 40 licensed cheesemakers. Now there are over 100. And that's, you know, over the course of not quite 12 years. Maine is the fastest growing number of cheesemakers in the entire country. But the difference between, say, Vermont and Maine is that there are cheesemakers who are literally making cheese with four animals, like four goats or four cows. So these micro creameries exist. So that might only be selling their products on their own farm or at the local farmers markets. And then they're going on up the scale to someone like Pineland Farms, who is making, I think, what they just recently say, like 1 million pounds of cheese a year. I mean, it is an extremely large amount. And I make about 7,500 pounds of cheese a year. So I'm smaller scale. But yeah, I think a lot of it does come down to just not people just not making the connection yet with Maine cheese. I hope that will change soon because Maine is definitely on the map for its beer culture now. And what's better than, you know, cheese and beer?
literally nothing. Literally.
Yeah, I think that's a great pairing. When we're talking Maine cheese, and I know you mentioned you have your own farm and you have your own cows now, does the climate, the Maine climate, affect the milk and the flavor of the cheese when you're producing it?
So when I started the business, I was buying milk from a farm that was all the way up in the northern part of the state. Then when I, then things changed. So basically, over the course of the 11 years, my cheese has been made with milk of 4 different farms, my farm included, and I can taste the difference. Some of that is what the cows are eating. So everyone that I have purchased milk from, and of course here at the farm, we're grazing the cows, we're feeding them hay. But depending on what it is they're eating, if they're eating a lot of clover or a lot of timothy, it very much changes the structure, the texture. Texture isn't really the word, but sort of mouth texture almost of the milk. I am slightly milk obsessed, so I feel like my milk palate may be a little bit more advanced than say maybe some other folks. But you really,
that makes total sense though, considering your business is cheese. That makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I start every cheese making day by drinking the milk. You know, I want to see what it's tasting like right now. Like there are sometimes when the cows get into a patch of spring onions in the field, and like, boy, do you smell it? You don't in the milk. You don't so much taste it. But we're also a saltwater farm here. We're a saltwater farm, so the cows are, you know, breathing in all that beautiful salt air. And you know, I think very much you can talk about terroir of milk, which I don't think that many people are doing. I've said again and again that one of these days I'm going to offer a milk and cheese pairing, you know, so you can be seeing, trying to identify what it is the cows are eating and trying to pick those notes out of the cheese. But I have yet to fully commit to it.
It's so interesting that you use the word terroir because, you know, you said cheese and beer, like, it's a no-brainer, but also cheese and wine. Like, and, you know, it's a natural pairing. And a quick, like, sort of aside, but like, I'm hosting this wine tasting next week here at the college, and it's all about East Coast wines and how, through whatever climate shift has happened, the terroir has improved and it's become more beneficial to wines that normally were shunned. And do you think that makes a difference in how quickly Maine is evolving in the cheese market? And do you think that it has improved in the cheese in some way?
So I have like 12 different things I want to want to comment on that. Because I farm here with my husband, and he has gotten the farm involved with this Soil Health Network Consortium. For the last, I guess it's been a year now, we've been working really hard at understanding what is happening in the soil here and trying to make sure that we're growing the best grasses for the health of the cows. But also in that 6 years that we've been on this property, we have already seen the change in the climate and how that's impacting how we can graze the animals and how water's running. Like we have, right, this area, the front pasture where we hold our farm-to-table suppers in the summertime, now from basically the time that it starts snowing, it turns into a giant pond. There's something that has shifted in the way that the ground is responding, that it just suddenly started retaining water. We have incredible erosion happening through the pig field, the pig yard, that this winter's pig yard, because we rotationally move the pigs through the forest as well. So that's kind of that's a big question, you know, because there are actual climate impacts that are happening. We've had 3 years of drought now in the summertime. And certainly all of those changes, they shock the grasses, right? They are impacting the trees, these climate changes. And of course it's going to impact the taste of grain. You know, there are all these, the main grains are huge and you've caused a collision of many thoughts in my head.
I guess that was probably, I'm sorry, but this is something that I think about a lot, right? Because as someone who's seen the world of food change, both intentionally and, you know, by way of unintention, by our actions, I just think it's so important to think about this on a philosophical level. It's like how have things evolved? Agree.
Yeah.
It's heavy, right? It's a really heavy question. And I don't know, I feel like the best person to ask, and the reason I put this on the list, is because ask a farmer, ask someone who's making this and has their hands literally in the process. No one is going to be able to, like every academic can say like, oh yes, this is happening. But like no one knows better than the boots on the ground. So that's why I wanted to bring that. And I appreciate you being honest and speaking to where like you've seen this even in the past 5-6 years.
Yeah, well, I mean, it impact. For example, it even impacts the hay. Like we make our own hay, both that we cut here at the farm, but we also have what are called free leases where we're cutting hay in other people's fields. But we've been seeing the quality of the hay go down because of the ground being stressed because of the changes in temperature it's all, I mean, that's the thing. It's all connected. And for anybody to sit around and say that nothing's happening here, they've got their head on a hole. And it's not a cheese hole.
Well, my question is a little lighter, and it goes back to something you said.
Thank you, Jamie. Thank you for bringing this up.
It goes back to something you said at the very beginning, is that you start each day by tasting the milk. And that made me really curious what your day looks like as a one-woman solo cheesemaker. I know you have some help now, but when you first started out and when we first met and I first had your cheese, you were doing this all on your own. So I'm really curious what a day in the life of a cheesemaker looks like beyond tasting the milk that you're working with.
Sure. So I am still making the cheese by myself. And the help that I have is... she's doing the cut and wrap for the wholesale orders and washing the endless numbers of dirty cheese molds. Because really, cheese making is about 85% washing.
Well, I mean, that's
dishes.
Helpful.
But so my day starts off with, oh my gosh, a dishwasher in any food industry is really the most important person on the line. So shout out to the people who are willing to wash dishes. So my day starts off with a really good cup of coffee and going and gathering the milking equipment, which has to be sanitized, going down to the milking parlor. And the cows, right now, there are only 6 cows that are being milked. I've got 3 that are about to give birth. And... they know the order that they come in. So they come in. Now we are still operating here on pretty minimalist. The milking parlor is unheated, which has been an issue when it's been minus 20 and minus 40, like it was a couple of weeks ago. And, anyway, so get the milk milked and then carry it by buckets up to the bulk tank. And that's fun because it's uphill. This entire farm is uphill both ways.
It actually exists.
And so, it does. So get the cows milked. This is truthful. I take a shower because, you know, cross-contamination is a real thing. And Neil very nicely gets breakfast made and then I come into the cheese room. If it's a cheese making day, I get all my equipment set up, get the milk into the vat and get things going there. And then I start working down my list of turning the cheeses that have been made and are in the aging cave or salting the previous day's cheeses, getting them ready to go into the aging cave, prepping wholesale orders, and endlessly washing dishes if I don't have help. And then suddenly it's time to milk cows again in the evening and then dinner and then sleep. And I still do make delivery. I still have a delivery route. Pretty much if you will never find me at the farm on a Thursday. So I have about 150 mile both ways route that I run down the coast of Maine to some of the customers that would prefer to not buy from either the distributors or have me ship. And then depending on where we are in the year, we might have, it might be the time of year when we have what we call the cowside suppers, which where we bring in guest chefs from some of the finest restaurants around, and they are required to use a minimum of 4 products from the farm, and it's limited to 20 guests, and they're great, great fun. We also have a summer house where you can book up to 6 people for a private party where we either do this incredible cheese feast or a fondue party. And so, yeah, so it's,
oh, those, the, all that sounds like so much fun.
Oh my God. It really are. And both Neil and I come from, you know, education backgrounds. We want people to be understanding what it is, not only what it is we do here, why we do things here, the way we do, but also, you know, what this food is. I mean, we have jowl from our pigs for sale. Not everybody knows how to cook jowl, you know? so one of the things that we have done also, not so much since 2020, but we offer cooking classes as well and culinary skills classes.
Very cool.
So Allison, I mean, you have so much going on, and like, it makes me like crazy just to even think about this, because aside from all the other educational components and dinners you have going simultaneously, you're also a farmer. And I think I'd be remiss if I didn't say this, that like, we always paint a picture as the restaurant industry being, you know, incredibly stressful, no days off. As a dairy farmer, there are literally no days off. And I can tell you, like, I have my wife's uncle is a dairy farmer in Massachusetts. He came to our wedding for 3 hours because he was milking the cows and they had to go back and milk the cows. Can you talk about the level of commitment that it takes to really do this right? And, you know, as a way to sort of inspire people to maybe enter the world of farming, because we know that it's taken a dip.
I don't think that I would inspire anybody to get into it, because I willingly talk about the realities of things. You know, we haven't gone out to dinner in ages, because now that the herd is larger, it takes longer to milk. And any good evening stuff happens at milking time, and then it's just a little too tired to get going. So, in the evening. So, but I mean, I absolutely love it. I mean, here's the thing: I will whinge about some things, but honestly, at this point, I kind of can't imagine doing anything else. And I will say, I'm in my mid-50s. You know, so it's not like I'm some young chippy doing this. This is incredibly physical work, but I get to cuddle cows every day. And is anything more adorable than a newborn piglet? And I've got these great relationships with these animals. And but yeah, leaving for 3 hours, I totally get that. That happens on occasion. You have to do a lot of planning in the day. I mean, the days are the same. I mean, you know what I mean? You're like, you know, it's going to be starting and ending with milking cows and feeding pigs. But what happens in between are variations on a theme, you know. So on the days that I'm making cheese, there's a set. I'm doing exactly the same thing for a 9-hour period. But on days that I'm not actively making cheese, I'm doing other cheese work or making the prepared foods for the farm store. So it's, you know, I always talk about lifelong learning. I'm always learning something new about cheese and trying to improve my skills there. I'm always learning something new about the livestock, because it's important to me. I mean, what's happening with the livestock impacts the cheese. So I want to make sure that they're as healthy as possible. And so Neil and I have lots of conversations about what the cows are eating and where they are in their lactation and who's getting dried off, getting prepared to give birth. And it's, I feel like people who are considering about getting into farming really should talk to some people. You know, if you've got a lot of money and can just start off and have everything at, you know, the way it should be to make your life easier right away, go ahead, get into farming right now. Otherwise, just start small. And I think that's kind of the biggest thing is don't just say, okay, yes, I want to have 16 cows and make cheese from it and I have no experience. No, get a cow and live with it. Put up a really good fence for that cow and make sure she stays in. I'm kind of obsessed with fencing.
I mean, speaking of starting small, this is actually a really great segue into one of the cheeses you make is your basket ricotta. And I know that you make multiple cheeses, but when you make ricotta, we make ricotta in one of my classes. It's a small way for them to control a cheese product on their plate that we can do in a short amount of time. And my students are always asking what they can do with the whey. And I have a few ideas of how we can repurpose it, but I'm curious what you do with all of the whey from the byproduct of your basket ricotta.
Well, all of the whey from all of my cheeses actually gets fed to our pigs because it's incredibly nutritious and incredibly addictive. I will tell you that when we are in an in-between period when they've eaten all the whey and have to give them water, they don't want to drink the water.
Interesting.
Yeah. Oh, it's a riot. But you can use whey as the liquid if you're baking bread. You can use it in soups and stocks. It's actually not so much with the ricotta whey regular. Because that's just way too acidic for me. But regular cheese whey, either a soft cheese or a hard cheese. Chill it on a hot day and it's like really good lemonade. but yeah, just trying it as sauces and bread. I really like, I make bread every week and, I like incorporating, when I remember to save myself some whey, not give it to the pigs. I really like the way it goes in the bread. Cause I make a no need bread and
yes, that's one of my favorites too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, and, I use only main grains flours. So I'll play around with the proportions. Sometimes I'll do all white. Sometimes it's got buckwheat or rye or, different proportions. But when the whey is in there, it really transforms the bread. I mean, I'm all about fermentation. Like, fermentation is my life.
It really is. And I know you make other styles of cheese as well. What's one of your most popular cheeses that you make?
Well, rockweed is the cheese that as of last year transformed my cheese making existence. It's a bloomy rind cheese that has a ribbon of dried bladderwrack seaweed in the center. So it's this wonderfully creamy and briny cheese. And I'm now best known for that because
it sounds delightful.
Oh my gosh, it's amazing. I'll put a plug in. If you're in the Boston area, they have it at Formaggio South End. but they have, but that cheese last year, exactly a year ago, won a gold medal at the World Cheese Championship contest. And that was a really big deal because there were thousands of cheeses that entered in the competition and hundreds of cheesemakers. And here I am, me in my little creamery and managed to pull off impressing the judges. And I was so fortunate that people really got interested in the story. And so I got both great local and national publicity. And it was because of that, that I was able to hire an employee last year.
Wow.
That's awesome. I'm looking at it on your website. It looks divine. It looks so good. And it sounds so, so interesting.
It's amazing that like that moment happened because from this whole process of starting out in a field that had, no direct connection to cheese making to taking, you know, the making the choice to do this and then to eventually getting recognized on such a large scale, it's so inspiring. So like you said earlier, like you're not inspiring. Like I would call bullshit on that. I think you are. I think that it's something that
agreed.
If you're committed and this is for you, like it's a way of life, right? It's definitely something you have to be bought in on.
Yeah.
Like it can be rewarding. I want to ask a question because I read an article about you and it was, you listed all these steps into becoming a master cheesemaker. And like, I found it weird that the last step that you listed was taking the leap. And while that makes sense that like, eventually you have to like take the plunge, it seems crazy that you would go through all these other steps before you even fully committed. Can you talk about how scary it was to actually take the leap from one really solid career path to something that is unknown?
Yeah, it's going off the cliff. Coming from the nonprofit world is a mixed blessing, right? Because you end up in museums, you end up ending up having to wear a lot of hats and getting a lot of different skills. So I learned about doing social media marketing, well, just marketing in general, and writing budgets, and I definitely developed all of the skills that I would need to own my own business because I was in the nonprofit world, I wasn't coming to this with starting the business with a lot of savings. You know, this was literally bootstrapped on starting the business, and you know, I had a mortgage, and I didn't know. I was fortunate when I started the business that I was single, so I wasn't having, I had to make sure the dog was fed and the mortgage was paid. So it was a little bit easier to say, okay, this is going to work out. But to take milk, turn it into cheese, and then convince people to buy it, you know, like I was literally showing up at the back doors of restaurants and saying, hey, try my cheese and put it on your menu. Maybe, that is how I started my business. I was going around, to retail stores and saying, here I am, the new cheesemaker in town. Let's see if we can get your customers to be interested. And along with that, I also, this is sort of a segue, but so on my social media on Lakin's Gorgeous Cheese on Instagram and Facebook, on Wednesdays, I have what I call Recipe Wednesday, where I post recipes that encourage people to use the cheese in different ways, because I feel like people get stuck in the way that they eat
cheese.
True,
yeah.
You know, it's really easy to think about, making mac and cheese, but what about making stromatic, which is way better and more interesting, and look it up. It's on my website. My website still, I've got over 200 recipes through my social media, and I have like 6 recipes on the website. That's something I need to improve. But yeah, it was absolutely a leap of faith, because I had to believe that with the skills that I have and with the passion that I have, that I was going to be able to pull this off and make a living. And this is going to be my 12th year. So
That's absolutely incredible. And you did allude to where people can find you online. What about in stores? You said Fromaggio in Boston. Are there any other places that people can find your cheese?
Well, throughout Maine, it's on the menu at a bunch of different restaurants and in many of the local specialty stores. But I have a website and you can order, and I ship nationwide. And that's probably an easier way. If you go to my website, there is a tab called Where to Buy. You can look and see if there are any stores I'm listing there. But yeah, the website's a great place to go.
Awesome. Well, we are going to encourage everyone to check that out. And we want to thank you so much for taking the time in your busy day to chat with us all things cheese. It was really inspirational. And I loved your mindset on all of this and how you looked at it as a learning experience. And I think that's a great mindset to have. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks again to Allison Lakin from Lakin Gorgeous Cheese for joining us today on the podcast. It was so inspiring to hear her story about becoming a master cheesemaker in Maine. Also, thanks to Matt Burns, who does all the music for the Culinary Now podcast. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook at Culinary Now Podcast.
And if you like this episode or any of our previous episodes, please leave us a 5-star review. It helps us to be able to continue on with this project. You can also reach out to us by email for suggestions, topics, or guests you'd like to see us have on the pod at culinarynowpodcast@gmail.com.
We'll talk to you soon.